Hello and welcome to our latest Fraser of Allender podcast. My name is Emma Congreve and today we're looking at agriculture and the rural economy and the impacts of COVID-19. So we've all heard at the start of this crisis big concerns over food supply when we were seeing empty shelves in the supermarket, but thankfully those concerns were short-lived. But there are other issues bubbling up, from dairy farmers being forced to throw away milk to concerns over the labour available to bring in this year's harvest. So coronavirus is having implications for the supply chain and farmers in Scotland now, and will continue to have over the medium term. Joining me today to talk through some of these issues, I'm glad to say we are joined by Professor Andrew Barnes from Scotland's Rural College and his colleague Stephen Thompson. Can I just ask, if you could give a bit of an introduction to Scotland's Rural College and the type of work you guys have been doing over recent weeks.
Yeah, sure. SRUC stands for Scotland's Rural College. The department we're in is the Rural Economy, Environment and Society. So that's a large grouping of economists and social scientists. And we've been working on land use and rural issues, as well as food consumption issues around the supply chain. So we have been quite involved in terms of helping to inform local policy in terms of Scottish Government policy, but we also work with DEFRA as well in terms of issues around uptake of climate change and biodiversity type policies as well. In the current crisis, we've been called on to work on some very short investigations in terms of specific issues around the supply chain itself. And you mentioned labour and you mentioned waste there, but also in the background as well, we do a lot of work on Brexit, which is still going on in the background. So a number of things that we'll talk about today probably have to be framed against Brexit as well, and how the industry is trying to reconfigure or respond to some of those policy uncertainties as well.
Brilliant, thanks Andrew. Okay, so just for those of us who don't know a lot about the industry in Scotland, could we start by talking a bit about how important agriculture and the domestic food supply chain is to our economy in Scotland, and how do we go about kind of measuring its impact as well?
Yeah, well, agriculture on paper has a very small economic footprint. It has less than 1% of our gross value added at the primary sector. But at the food and drink manufacturing sector and supply sector, it's around about 17% of our gross value added. In terms of employment as well, there's a low level of employment in the primary sector, but then a large amount of employment going up the chain as well. It's also important to note that a large amount of our natural capital is being managed by these businesses as well. So that's a significant part of why we support agriculture. And also remember that in Scotland itself, we have a high degree of remoteness in rural communities. So historically, agriculture has played a part in terms of the fabric of the rural economy in those areas to help to create chains of networks and so on and so forth.
I think there's a key thing that we need to acknowledge as well, is whilst agriculture's got a small footprint at the national economy level, in the rural economy it actually contributes to around 10% to the sort of revenues earned, and employs roughly 8%, so agriculture, forestry and fishing. So the primary sector actually has a more important role in that rural economy alongside tourism. And of course, there's intrinsic links between a working natural environment and the tourism economy. So whilst it might not be so important in the national economy, it is vital for the rural economy. And Andrew makes a very good point that agriculture is often forgotten as part of a wider food chain. So when you consider the added value from the starting point, the inputs into agriculture, to the retail sector, then we get the true reflection of the scale of this this sector and what it contributes to the economy. In terms of the wider, the peripherality issues, there's been an awful lot of differences with regards to COVID and how the economy of farming is actually surviving and thriving in some instances. But if we go back to the basics, agriculture roughly contributes or generates about 3 billion in turnover a year, and it spends roughly 3 billion in terms of costs. So what comes in goes out into suppliers, machinery purchases, fertilizer, feed, etc. So there's really strong linkages in between the land-based sector and the non-land-based sector. And we've done some recent work for the Scottish Government looking at the non-land-based rural business sector, where we're finding roughly sort of 50% of those businesses have got some reliance on agriculture, and about two-thirds of them have got reliance on the land-based sector for turnover. Now, that might just be a small part of their turnover, but they've still got some degree of connectivity with the sector, which just goes to show that whilst the story of it being a linchpin of the rural economy, it's probably been misquoted a lot of the times or misused, because tourism is probably the key sector alongside public sector workforce. That it still has that really important connective role in the rural economy. So if we go back to the sectors, the key sectors, the red meat sector, so beef production contributes a significant proportion alongside arable. And then if you come down further down the chain, you go into the dairy sector. And then sheep is around 7 or 8%. Pigs are always underestimated in the statistics, so probably about 5 or 6%. Poultry, similar amount. And then horticulture is the sector that's been probably increasing its proportion of the total agricultural output over the last 15 to 20 years, and it's now roughly about 10%. And we contribute, from Scotland, we contribute roughly, I think it's over a quarter of all soft fruit production in the UK. So even though we're a relatively small part of the UK in terms of population, we punch above our weight in terms of soft fruit, in terms of spring barley, which of course is used for whiskey, and also in things like seed potato. Scotland is vital for seed potato production because we have got less viruses in the... It's interesting when we're talking about COVID, we're talking about virus and things like that that's affecting potatoes. So we've got an international reputation for seed potato. And of course, during the run-up to the Brexit deadlines, the numerous Brexit deadlines, there's been concerns about seed potato exports into Egypt and Morocco, because most of them are transited through Europe. So there's a number of issues that are ongoing as we speak.
Thanks for that. That's really interesting and gives us a great overview of the sector and how it is the foundation of many other businesses and, of course, the domestic food supply chain. So let's talk a little bit about some of the issues being faced by the sector due to COVID-19 and getting food from farm to plate.
I suppose there's been two major issues, really. The first one is the soft fruit sector and the vegetable sector, who are reliant on a pretty large seasonal migrant workforce, which normally come, nowadays it comes from mostly Bulgaria and Romania. These workers come over and will work for 3 months, 4 months, 5, 6, 7, 8 months, at a time, living on farms in caravans normally. And then they're picking the soft fruit, so strawberries, raspberries, etc., which are not that easily harvested by machinery. So they're a vital part of a massive agribusiness cog. And this is a sector that has not historically been supported through the Common Agricultural Policy. These businesses have got together, they've done their own research and development in terms of products and systems. So it is a real sector that's fully focused on the business, on business models. And with COVID and the restriction of movement of people, it's brought to light the absolute need for this workforce. And of course, in about 2 years ago, we did some work for Scottish Government where we estimated that the total labour demand is about 10,000. It's just shy of 10,000 workers a year for this sector. So the risk was that the vegetable sector wouldn't plant crop because they were potentially going to undergo a significant expense without any guarantee of workers to pick or to harvest. And the fruit sector is already marching towards, well, it's already picking, started picking in late March, and some of the farms will pick into November. And their concern is that whilst they've got some of their workforce here, they are still needing quite a large number to come in. And there then was a matching service set up where people could register an interest to go and work on farms, which a number of people have done. So the story I've heard is that over 50,000 people across the UK registered to go and work on farms. Not many have actually undertaken that opportunity. Those that have undertaken it, very few have come back the next day. So it is a hard work. It is a pretty hard work. So, of course, there's hopes. And G's, who are a major supplier south of the border, they were the first to charter a plane to bring in workers from Romania. I think it was Romania they brought in. And, of course, I think quite a few of the soft fruit producers are hoping that will be an option going forward, but the 14-day quarantine will actually add significant costs to that. So whenever there's it seems for them that there's a constant set of hurdles being placed upon them that is stopping them potentially running businesses, inefficient businesses, and supplying the market with food. The second sector that really has felt it is the dairy sector, where you mentioned earlier that farmers are being asked to restrict supply. So the food service sector has disappeared, the hospitality sector has disappeared, and these were huge consumers of milk. So everybody that had a latte or a milky coffee, that was all contributing to the dairy sector. All of the cheeses that are used in the catering side of things. So the demand has fallen off a cliff edge, and we're not as bad as in England and Wales. In England and Wales, some farmers are really, really struggling. Czechs, the processors are supplying them only with about a quarter to half of their milk check, their monthly milk check, which causes real cash flow problems for them. But suppliers in Scotland have been asked to restrict by 3%. So if you take off 3% off their cash flow straight away, and of course some will be worse hit than others. So that dairy sector is the sort of second biggest impact. And the third one will be the beef side of things, where we've now got a major issue with carcass balancing. And carcass balancing is where there's cheap cuts and expensive cuts, and there's offal and there's hides. And all of those parts of an animal contribute to the sort of the profit that the processor can make out of it. And of course, what we've seen is a huge upsurge in demand for cheap cuts or for sausages, for mince and things like that. Whereas steaks and joints, which normally would go into hospitality and food service sector, they're not being bought by the consumer in the supermarket. Hence, you're now starting to see 2-for-1 deals or really cheap steaks in the market, because the storage that they've got of all these steaks means that they're now trying to offload supply. So that carcass balancing is a real issue for the sector, which means that the price for beef animals it remains very suppressed. Mm. And farmers are probably losing finishers, the beef finishers, those that specialise in taking a younger animal to maturity, to slaughter weight, they're probably losing money on every single animal just now.
Mm. Yeah, so I mean, farmers will be used to over the years facing ups and downs. There have been plenty of crises facing the sector. What kind of support is in place due to the issues from COVID-19? I mean, have there been particular Scottish Government support schemes put in place? And actually, what role does the support that's in place well, previously from the Common Agricultural Policy, but that's, you know, continuing in some form at the moment, isn't it? So how do farmers kind of cope with this kind of crisis, and is there help out there for them?
Well, you're right in saying that there's ups and downs. Also, to add on what Stephen's saying about migrant labour force as well, there are long-term economic trends where, say, Eastern European economies are developing and it's far more attractive to work. And that's not just a problem for Scotland, it's a problem for Western Europe as well in terms of the labour force. So there has to be this level of adaptation coming in. In terms of specific support, I'm not aware of it in terms of the Scottish context, but you do see European Commission releasing some loans or low-cost loans for support in COVID, say, in Italian regions, specifically to get them through this particular period. In terms of overall support, I don't see any change in the support framework. They do get, Stephen could tell you more about this in terms of the structure of the payments. They get a sort of basic payment, which is effectively income support, effectively to try to mitigate some of the highs and lows of what happens on a yearly basis within farming itself, but also more directed support in terms of things like allowing new entrants into the industry, allowing them to move away from more sort of productivity type work into supporting the public goods that we've all heard about in terms of the future non-EU policy as well. We've just done some work for the Scottish Government, taking a sort of blue skies approach to how to encourage productivity itself. And that's taking a whole range of things from redirecting the current levels of support towards even things like giving farmers a sort of training fund for the rest of their life. And then they can choose which particular training they perceive, or capital support for things like precision agriculture type farming as well. So there's a whole range of things that are on the table, I would say, certainly not, maybe not in the short term, but post 2024, when you know, things will kick in terms of our local policy.
I would just add that what the Scottish Government have done with regards to COVID has been that they've expedited payments much quicker than perhaps would have been the case. So where they've been able to, they've pushed the money out the door as fast as they possibly can, so that there is no opportunity for the farmers to be faced with that cash flow crisis that might be occurring somewhere in that supply chain. There's also been a derogation to a thing called greening, and this greening is 30% of the payments that farmers get. So they have to, if they've got an arable farm, they've got to plant three different crops. And it's a European condition to try and stop large areas of monoculture in some of the Eastern European areas and Cambridgeshire, etc. It's not really suitable for Scotland, but it's always been a real issue when there's been a wet autumn and a cold spring, because then all of the planting comes around one period and not all crops are suitable for planting at that time. So there's been a derogation that farmers don't have to comply with that this year. And of course, farmers are able to apply for the financial support other businesses are able to apply for. So there's not really been anything specific for the sector in terms of any additional payments beyond what they would normally get from CAP. And apart from, we've been very fortunate, or perhaps unfortunate in the longer term, we were there's been convergence funding. So the European Union in 2014 said that regions and member states that were below the EU average should come and coalesce towards the EU average, and the UK government got an uplift for that. Scotland was the region that basically caused the UK to be below the average, but we didn't get, we only got 69% of the money. So there was an independent review, which meant that the money is now coming north to Scotland, and Boris Johnson said that he would right the wrongs of the past, and has produced a pretty healthy cheque for Scotland. And that convergence money between last year and this year, it's been a vital uplift for farmers in Scotland in terms of giving them some additional income that they might not have had had the convergence review not gone in our favour.
That's really interesting. Yeah, good timing, perhaps, as you say. We're going to come back about and talk a little bit about Brexit and the implications of where we are in that, and combined with the COVID-19 crisis. But just before we do that, I'm sure we touched on tourism a little bit, and as the other kind of key sector for rural areas. But I wonder if there's anything you can say about how wider businesses in rural areas have been affected, and if there's anything in particular that stood out as an issue. And again, there's a lot of interconnected businesses with agriculture and diversification, so it does all come back to the same people sometimes. So if there's anything we can discuss about that, that would be really interesting.
So what we were doing, we've been doing for the last 3 years with Scottish Enterprise and Scottish Government funding, is a rural business survey in Dumfries and Galloway, Borders, Tayside and Aberdeenshire. And it's looking at non-land-based businesses. And what we've done is we've looked beyond just rural. So we're looking in towns, and we're also looking in the urban fringes. So we looked at postcodes where we've got not natural supply chains. And we were in the midst of the third tranche of annual interviews when COVID started. And we managed, and we were collecting data. So what I did was I've analysed it from the data set from before the 12th of March, from the 12th of March to the 23rd of March, which was the sort of, you shouldn't really be going out and about, you should try and social distance, and then 3rd of March to the 1st or 2nd of April, which was the lockdown period, when the lockdown started. And what you saw was you saw the confidence, business confidence, disappearing pretty rapidly. And then we managed in the last week to throw in two questions specifically on COVID. And you saw that particularly in the construction and tourism sector, major issues that were coming forward in that. I think in the tourism one, the businesses, I think 60-odd% of those businesses thought that it would mean closure, which was quite startling. Now, that whether that was temporary or long-term closure, that's something to go back and try and work out. But for the tourism sector, this is something I don't think anyone could ever imagine. And I've been in calls with DEFRA, who saying, is there lessons that we can learn from foot and mouth disease? And perhaps we do need to go back and actually look at what happened in the tourism sector for foot and mouth disease, less so the farming sector, because the farming sector, it was a supply shock, and now we've got a demand shock. And if you go back and actually look and see what happened with foot and mouth disease, it was a demand shock for the tourism sector. So we should maybe go back and actually look and see what happened then for that sector. There's a lot of hope that if the lockdown lifts, then there'll be a period where staycations and use of Scottish and UK tourism destinations will boom. But that's people actually, you have to think, well, will the consumer have the confidence to go to visitor attractions or go and stay somewhere? Well, if you were a farm business, would you actually want tourists coming onto your business that potentially could bring in the COVID virus? And then will the consumers have the financial confidence if we're suddenly in an economic downturn or recession? Will they have the economic confidence to go forward? So there are a number of things ongoing. The Scottish Tourism Alliance have been doing some survey work of their membership, which is showing some quite startling figures with regards to cash availability. And of course, if the government schemes suddenly start being reduced because the government can't afford to continue to support businesses and furloughed staff, then the cash will run out for some businesses, which will be terminal. And that's the biggest worry that I think a lot of these businesses have. They don't want to take on more debt, you know, in a period of real uncertainty, because you have to pay back those debts. So the grants are being uptaken, but not loans in all cases.
Yeah. This period of uncertainty, you know, it's obviously common across businesses, rural or urban, but with the concentration of particular key sectors in rural areas, it does definitely ramp up and, you know, does call into question kind of the future survival of a large amount of businesses, as you say, and communities as a whole. So,
yeah, and I think that's maybe where farming actually, agriculture actually has got a major contribution, because, you know, the farming sector will continue in that role in terms of those businesses. You know, people will continue farm and food production will continue. The relative importance of that then suddenly, if other sectors of the economy aren't functioning as we know, or as we used to know, then suddenly agriculture or primary sector employment and industries might become more important to these communities and the survival. And Andrew's done quite a bit of work on business viability within the farming sector. And he can perhaps talk about that, even with the cap payments, there's a proportion of the farming sector that aren't viable with regards to the prices received and the costs of production.
Yeah, that's it. If I can come in there. Yeah. It's the fragility of the business as well. And what we looked at was just the entire range from very vulnerable businesses to what we'd call quite robust businesses who could survive some of these shocks as well. And what happens is most of the fragile businesses are in these remote rural areas. So you could have this perfect storm effectively where, yeah, as Stephen says, farming businesses could continue, but in fragile areas, these could go down as well. So it may be a sort of double shock for these very remote areas if you're looking at a very sort of microeconomic perspective as well. But I think what's important from that work that we did was really just even within areas where you see a sort of biophysical disadvantage, you get a whole range of performance. And that's down to skills, that's down to management, that's down to certainly things like succession planning. You know, remember the average age of the farmer is about 58. So, you know, if you can plan successfully to, you know, get someone to inherit the business or allow new entrants in, then maybe engender some more innovation towards not just farming, but towards, you know, other supply chains or other diversification as well activities. Mm-hmm. So within all that, there's no, I think Stephen will agree that there's no such thing as one typical farm. And within that, I think you get a whole series of motivations as to why people are farming. And that has, in some areas, quite significant consequences for the rural economy as well.
So let's move on just to sort of on that theme, talk about kind of the viability of businesses in the medium to longer term. So both due to what's going on at the moment and some of the challenges that puts upon the sector. Also in terms of Brexit and the changes to, or the potential changes to how monetary support is given to farms across the UK, but obviously particularly in Scotland. And as you say, you know, most people don't get into farming because there's money to be made, but it's critical to be able to survive in order to be able to carry on. And without the certainty of the payments that have been, you know, in the system from the Common Agricultural Policy for many years now, some of that viability for some farms may now be in doubt. So how do you see things sort of changing in terms of attitudes and approaches and the general policy discussion in terms of farming over the next few years?
Well, first, I think Stephen would probably have an opinion on this, but I think what's important before we do that is understanding the cost structure of some of these farms. And certainly this issue of wealth is very important in terms of, you know, we have land ownership and we have tenanted farms as well. And as Stephen alluded to there, there's high levels of debt, and that's fine if you have lots of land as a capital asset. So I mean, within that, there's a highly political issue about land ownership and how subsidies have helped to capitalize those sort of land values as well. And also you have the classic 80-20 rule here, where, you know, 20% own 80% of the wealth. So you have a whole spectrum of responses to this in terms of their fragility to the coming shocks, really. I think maybe Stephen would have something to say about that.
Yeah, the Pareto principle also impacts on food production. So pretty much every sector you look at, it's 20% of the producers produce 80% of the output, which comes back to your point about different motivations. And I think we always have to be careful with the phrase that farmers tend not to get into farming to make profit, because every businessman should be able to make a profit from their production. And unfortunately, we're in a system where we tend to have very cheap food. And of course, that's one of the objectives, longer term objectives of the UK government. That's why we were wanting to enter into free trade agreements with all the different countries around the world, out with the EU. And part of the negotiations will be food access, or agri-food access, whether that's meat from America or chicken from Asia. There will be pressures on our governments to open our doors to even more food production or food product. Mm-hmm. So I think the key thing going forward is, and when we talk about policy, quite often people forget that trade and agricultural support policies go hand in hand. So until we actually understand what the trade position is, we probably don't really understand fully what we need to do in order to maintain and support the agriculture sector. So once we have a better understanding of A, with our negotiation position with Europe, B, with America, Canada, Australia, etc., then we will have a far better understanding. And we've already seen a snapshot of Brexit occurring with food sector with COVID. So that we practically saw the hardest Brexit you could ever imagine in terms of food product going straight off the shelves. That was predicted that would happen under a no-deal Brexit. All the supermarkets predicted that they would run out of stock. We would have to buy stock from wherever we could get it, which is why you saw things like Polish beef coming in, and we're more and more Irish beef. So we are still heavily reliant on beef supply from Ireland. We're a major importer of beef. And of course, under Brexit, a lot of farmers had thought, well, this is an opportunity, A, for dairy production, and B, for beef production. But what's happened is the UK government, without the tariff protection or having very low tariff protection announced, basically said, well, we want cheap food. We're not really going to support your industry and create opportunity for your industry to generate more income, create more product. So that was the first point. The second point is, in Scotland, the Scottish government, Fergus Ewing, has been very, very consistent in saying stability and simplicity until 2024. So that is actually coming home to actually be very effective, perhaps now, because COVID is requiring some degree of stability in terms of policy support to ensure that farmers have got the right signals to actually make sure that production continues. So the stability message has been vital. So post 2024, there's a whole host of things that the government are looking at. And of course, in England and in Wales and Northern Ireland, things are moving in different, slightly different directions. But everybody is coalescing around the need for perhaps a greener agricultural support mechanisms, where farmers are paid for these public goods that they deliver, which could be clean air, clean water, biodiversity, reduced greenhouse gas emissions. So focusing on productivity will be vital, because when you are productive and doing things to the best of your ability, then you have less waste within the system. There's less emissions per kilo of product, etc. So there's a whole series of pilot schemes, and you know, people are thinking long and hard about how we move away from a pretty crude payment mechanism, which is on how much land you've got. and the quality of that land to something about more of what are you producing for society. And you can see in the longer term, there will be some kind of contractual basis as to what farmers are doing. There'll be more conditionality on what they're providing for the public, whether that's wildlife or, as I said, greenhouse gas emissions or reduced flooding measures, etc. So there's the move is across Europe. It's not just in UK. It's not just in Scotland. There's a whole host of people looking at future agricultural policy and moving away from this very crude mechanism, which covers across covers all of Europe just now.
And do you think what we're going through at the moment and people's shift to thinking about issues like food security might change some of those policy discussions going forward?
Yes, I think we're already seeing that. So with COVID, with the COVID crisis, we've actually seen perhaps a resurgence in a bit of understanding from consumers about local supply chains. And whether or not that filters into policy and trade policy is yet to be seen. But I think there's an understanding that actually being able to supply yourselves in times of crisis with food is actually vital. You know, we've seen that. So in one example where farming has done very well out of COVID is in the poultry sector, where you know the egg producers cannot get their hens to lay enough eggs to satiate the demand, which is why and sometimes you go to the supermarket, there's no eggs to be bought. Because people are staying at home doing home baking, and we're not importing into food service sector frozen egg product or dried egg product. But the demand profile and the consumer demand profile is changing. It's whether it sticks, part of that sticks, and people do stuff more at home in the longer term, and it's how the economy recovers. You know, tourists coming to the UK. And their food consumption is a major source of revenue and also of food consumption. So how all of that picks up will affect the demand profile. So it's not just the politicians and policy, it's actually the on the ground that get all of this as well.
We've got a long way to go to work out what the new normal is going to be in the future. But thank you to you both for your discussion today. I think agriculture, as you say, will continue to be a crucially important part of the economy in Scotland. And maybe this crisis has taught us just how important it is. So thank you again. You can subscribe to our podcast through all the major streaming platforms, and you can get up to date on things we're writing about on the Scottish economy on the Fraser of Allender website at fraserofallender.org. Here we are posting regularly on issues around COVID-19 and the Scottish economy and wider society. On this website, you can also find links to our podcast and links to our Twitter page. So thank you for joining us today, and hopefully you'll be back soon.